This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Doc, it seemed like forever. Man, it's been a while. We've been preempted by football, but we're back.
We're back.
A lot has gone on. I'm excited to dig right into this, and we've got an amazing guest today. We have John Chu. He's an attorney, an expert in constitutional law. He has served under President George H.W. Bush and President Bush, and there were some times in the FISA courts there, but we're going to get to that maybe a little bit
your
later.
Your favorite court.
I'm a little nervous.
I know that I'm not going to be able to constrain you on that.
I'm a little bit nervous, but Mr. Chu, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to talk about presidential war powers today.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and it's a great pleasure to be with you and the people of Arizona.
Well, thanks, John. I want to start right in with we got a kind of a three-pronged notion about how to go about this. And we want to start with sort of ancient history, the Constitution of the United States. What does the Constitution say about war powers? Who makes these decisions?
Well, the Constitution is actually somewhat unclear. It certainly states that the Congress has the power to declare war. But it doesn't say anything beyond that. According to the history of the Constitution, the original text was that the Congress shall have the power to make war as opposed to declare war. But our founding fathers decided that make war was too unwieldy, and they didn't want the entire Congress to be involved with that. And so they changed the word make war into declare war. And so that language is held all the way through today, and that's what we have today.
Well, the other thing that the Constitution says is that it gives the President of the United States the title Commander-in-Chief, but I believe it's silent on what that means, is it not?
Well, what we only know from the history is that the Founding Fathers wanted the President of the United States. They didn't want a king because they had just overthrown one. But they wanted the military to be under civilian control, and they wanted the President of the United States to be that person, to be the one person or the executive branch to have control over the military and to be able to respond to military attacks. At that time, the young nation was concerned about incursions against the United States. Not only from Britain, but also from Mexico or Spain or France. And so they wanted the executive branch, meaning the president, to have the flexibility to respond and send the Continental Army wherever it needed to go.
The thing about that, and I think about the context of the 18th and early 19th century, I think in that period there was always a presumption, was it not, that if war was on the horizon, that Congress could deliberate and that we had time to, frankly, to react, and for that matter, to raise an army, because the original notion was that we wouldn't have a standing army.
That's right, Mike. However, because the Founding Fathers, the framers of the Constitution, specifically changed that language from make war to declare war, they were willing to give Congress time to deliberate and to raise the funds as necessary, but they also wanted to give the president or the executive branch the flexibility to respond as quickly as possible. Both Madison and Alexander Hamilton, and even General George Washington, who later became our first president, were very clear during the Constitutional Convention that they believed the executive was the only branch of government that could respond quickly enough to any kind of incursion against the United States.
Was there any discussion in the drafting of the Constitution, to your knowledge, that the Congress ever considered something that we might consider to be a limited military action? In other words, we have peace, we know what that is, nobody's shooting, war is all out. Did anybody ever back then, 200 and some odd years ago, consider the possibility that we might be engaged in more limited military operations that fell short of the definition of war?
Well, certainly not what we see in the 21st century today. However, besides the debate between the words make war and declare war, there was also a discussion of the phrase conduct war. And the framers at that time were vigorously debated as to not only between the executive and the Congress, but also between the states and the federal government. Please remember that by 1787, the Articles of Confederation, which predated the Constitution, had pretty much been a failure. And one aspect of the Articles of Confederation was that it gave the states, the individual states, a great deal of power. And the idea was that each state would be responsible for its own defense. Well, that wasn't going to work for a national government, even with only 13 states or former colonies at that time. So in the sense of, if you look at the words make war, declare war, and conduct war, well, conducting war, there is no size, there is no scope as to the definition of what war actually is. Looks like the framers were more concerned about the legal process as to what Congress would do or not do, as opposed to the actual scope of the war. At that time, the idea that the United States would involve itself in a humanitarian mission or try to insert itself into the civil war of another country, well, that just wasn't practical. You know, we didn't have the capabilities and we didn't have the technology in 1787 to be able to do what we can today.
Well, we settled on declare war, and I'm having some difficulty understanding the difference. To me, make or conduct might mean that Congress would have some power in determining the actual execution, but declare seems to be, to me, to mean authorize, but then get out of the way. Is that your interpretation, or is there any case law on that?
Mike, that's absolutely correct. The reason that make war and conduct war were eventually not used was because of the strong advocacy of General Washington. You must remember, I mean, General Washington was the one who won the Revolutionary War. And so, you know, a lot of the constitutional delegates were predisposed to listen to his advice. And both James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, both in their Federalist Papers and also in their floor debates, were very, very strong in saying that when it came to the defense of these United States, the executive branch and the commander-in-chief in particular should be able to act without any interference from Congress. However, the framers still gave the Congress what we call the power of the purse. Today's legislative lingo, we would say they had the budgetary power. So Congress had the power to raise armies, and of course today it means Air Force, Navies, and Marines too. But only the Congress had the power to raise the army. Only the Congress had the power to fund the army.
So that was kind of the checks and balances of the time, right?
That's right. That's correct. Because if Congress decided to give the military zero money, well, the executive could, you know, want to do whatever he wanted to do, but with no money, there was going to be no army.
They'd go to war by themselves, and I don't think any president's going to do that. I want to take a leap forward in time as we talk about post-World War II, basically when the United States became the cops of the world, the world's police, if you will, and talk about presidential power post-World War II coming up next. You're in the think tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with our very special guest, John Hsu, a constitutional attorney and a former advisor to both Presidents Bush. And specifically, we're talking about war powers, and our first segment dealt with kind of the ancient history, the constitutional history, but we're going to fast forward into the 20th century. Since World War II, we have bombed in Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Serbia, Somalia, Bosnia, Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, and Yemen. No declaration of war in any of those instances. In fact, as our guest pointed out to us, the United States has declared war only five times: War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, Spanish-American War, and the two world wars in this century. The question I have that I'd like to ask is, I wonder if we could walk through some of the post-World War II things. Let's talk about Truman, Eisenhower, Korea. What was the role of Congress in those wars, and to what extent did the president act with total autonomy?
In post-World War II, the United States was sitting on top of the world. It was the only one with the atomic weapons. It was the only one that hadn't been physically destroyed by World War II. And so it really became the leader of the world. But there was a movement in the Congress and also in the executive branch where the United States had to serve as sort of a policeman of the world, but not a policeman in the sense of trying to keep disputes apart, but an anti-communist policeman, a policeman to try and stop the spread of communism. And so what happened was Korea. And Korea officially is not a war. Officially, Korea is a police action. And that started in 1950, only 5 years after World War II. And President Harry Truman sent troops to South Korea without asking Congress for a declaration of war and having a United Nations resolution. It was the first time a president of the United States ever sent troops into a foreign land with a UN resolution, but not without congressional declaration of war. And Congress never bothered to fight it. Congress never bothered to argue it, because at that time, the entire government was very concerned about the spread of communism overseas. And so they let President Truman do what it is he wanted to do. As a side note, the Korean War is not over. The North and South signed an armistice, but there was never an ending to the war. And so that's why we have the demilitarized zone today. That's why we have thousands of troops in South Korea. And that's why the largest minefield in the world is right there at the 38th parallel.
Well, if it were a war, it would have been our longest. Probably felt like a war to the guys who fought in it, but I guess not in court. Let's fast forward to Vietnam. Tell us what the Gulf of Tonkin was.
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin, it was a situation where supposedly enemy ships had fired upon U.S. ships. It turned out that it was not the truth, but President Johnson, Lyndon B. Johnson, asked for and received a resolution from the Congress. And remember, Johnson was a former majority leader in the United States Senate and also a former congressman. And so, unlike most other presidents, he had great relationships in the Congress. And so there was a resolution called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution that allowed the United States certain flexibility into fighting the North Vietnamese. Again, the Vietnam War was part of what was known as the domino strategy. We didn't want South Korea to fall as a domino to the communists, and we didn't want South Vietnam to fall as a domino to the communists. The problem was that later on, the United States decided to go ahead and bomb North Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And that certainly wasn't covered by the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which ended up being repealed in 1970.
Well, I remember that, and I remember that Lyndon Johnson cited that as authorization for the war, but I believe by the time Nixon became president and the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was repealed, President Nixon stated that he didn't need that, that the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was not necessary to authorize the actions in Vietnam. At least that's my recall of it.
That's correct. President Nixon was very concerned about deferring a lot of the executive branch authority to the Congress. And part of the problem was, for Nixon, is that he didn't have the same relationship with the Congress as Lyndon Johnson did. First of all, Lyndon Johnson was a Democrat. Both houses of Congress were Democrat at the time.
And at that time, it was not only so, but the Democrats had been in control so long, nobody ever even envisioned a turnover. I mean, I remember meeting a Democratic staffer, and I said, well, if the at that time and said, well, if the Republicans ever, you know, took over the House, what, you know, would you keep your job? He said he wouldn't last 5 minutes. But he said that's never going to happen.
Never.
Well, we fast forward. Nixon's president. He faces a Democratic Congress. And I remember there was an attempt by Congress to assert greater control over the War Powers issue. They passed a War Powers Act. What did that say?
Well, they did. They passed a War Powers resolution, which required that the President of the United States had to inform Congress within 48 hours of committing armed forces to military action, and forbid the President from keeping those armed forces for more than 60 days without a specific authorization for the use of military force or a declaration of war. But Mike and Mike, even before the 1973 War Powers Resolution, the Congress put forth what was known as the Cooper Church Amendment, and that was, of course, Senator Frank Church from Idaho and John Cooper. They put a resolution, an amendment forward, saying that they wanted to, number one, use the power of the purse and end funding to U.S. ground troops in Cambodia and Laos after June 1970, specifically ban air operations in Cambodian airspace, and then probably the most controversial part was to end American support for South Vietnamese forces outside of South Vietnam. And that was a big deal, and it was probably the first time that the Congress was so aggressive in trying to restrict presidential authority. In 1973, Senator Church again went ahead and pushed the Case-Church Amendment, which basically prohibited further U.S. military activity in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. It required that the president had to secure congressional approval in advance. That also had never been done before.
Hey, John, I have to stop you there. We're up against a hard break. When we come back, I want to talk about moving forward. I want to get to our current presidency, current administration, maybe drop back a little bit with W. But we want to get to that next, right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're back with our special guest, John Hsu, in The Think Tank, and we are talking about presidential war powers. And we have just gotten through a little history lesson, a recent history lesson dealing with World War II. And John, I want to start out by making a, kind of an observation of, I think, the summary of what you said, that there have been a series of pieces of legislation ostensibly to restrict presidential war powers. But even following the letter of the Presidential War Powers Act, as a practical matter, the politics of it, if the President of the United States commits American troops to foreign soil, in my observation in recent history, it is almost impossible, has been almost impossible, for the Congress to do very much to thwart that.
Well, that's generally correct. You know, the senators were able to pull those amendments in Vietnam because Vietnam was such an unpopular war here domestically. But if they had tried to do it in any other context, I don't think they would have succeeded.
Well, I think the history is it started out popular. It was anti-communist and the, you know, from the mid-60s on, as it dragged on near unto a decade, it became over time increasingly unpopular. But the issue was, even then, the troops were on the ground and those who wanted to do something to restrict that were presented as, quote, not supporting our troops. And that was politically an incredibly powerful argument.
Well, it still is. But, you know, let me give you an example from George H.W. Bush, the 41 administration. Everybody remembers the Persian Gulf War, and when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, President Bush, 41, was able to pull together a huge international coalition and was also, more importantly, able to pull together the United States Congress to remove Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Now, the Congress did not declare war, but it was a clear situation politically and legally where the United States, leading a ginormous UN coalition was going to remove Saddam from power. There's a lot of criticism, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, that the UN coalition did not go into Baghdad after the war and remove Saddam from power, but the congressional authorization and the UN authorization did not allow that.
Well, I also remember one person who argued very vehemently that it would be foolhardy to go into Baghdad, and that person was Dick Cheney.
That's correct, and General Colin Powell backed him up as well. And so, but beyond the practicalities of trying to go into Baghdad and getting involved in street fighting, you know, they just the legal authorization wasn't there, and this very similar thing happened in 1992. There was a problem in Somalia. It was called Operation Restore Hope. The United Nations specifically asked the United States to help ease a humanitarian crisis, and it was pretty clear that the reason the Somali people didn't have any food was because these gangs had controlled the ports. So again, the president went to the Congress and received, now it was a Democrat Congress in 1992, and received authorization strictly to send in United States military personnel to secure and open the ports.
I want to move us, if I could, because we've got limited remaining time,
sure.
And all this is just a wonderful setup. We are talking about the prospect of bombing in Syria. There is a diplomatic mission underway, but if that falls through, the president says that he is going to take military action. Could you comment on the legality of that in the context of everything that we've talked about today?
Well, it's unlikely, I think, that that President Obama would be able to get a full UN resolution, if only because Syria is a client state of Russia, and Russia has a veto on the permanent five of the UN Security Council. So the president has already mentioned that he would throw the football into Congress's hands, probably knowing that Congress wouldn't be able to do anything. You have a Democrat Senate, a Republican House, and even the Republicans within the House are of various factions. So that would leave the president, again, with the power to do whatever he wanted in terms of committing U.S. military personnel to try and stop a civil war in Syria. I would state that politically, it doesn't look like there are any particular U.S. national interests at stake, like oil or other strategic interests in Syria. But the elections have consequences. And so President Obama, as long as he notifies Congress, and seriously, sending in, you know, 1,000 Marines is a good notification of Congress.
But one thing I think about
the power to do that.
One thing about this, I think, would be very different. Presidents have acted unilaterally before, but if Congress did not consent, I don't think there's ever been a case where the president asked for authorization, didn't get it, and then proceeded. Is there?
Not that I know of, but he still. There is a good legal argument that he still has the power to do that. The reason is because the only way that Congress could really stop him is to either A, pass a law that says specifically that President Obama is not to send any military personnel or commit military resources to Syria, or B, pass a law that specifically defunds any sort of action against Syria to stop the civil war.
But doesn't this come down to semantics, though? Doesn't this come down to, like, with Obamacare, it's a tax, or is it a mandate, or is it a penalty? We're going to make it constitutional that way. Now we're talking about war versus police action versus punitive measures. Isn't it just how we frame it to make it constitutional?
No, because the only way that it becomes constitutional is if the president asks the Congress for a declaration of war, which politically he would not get.
And he would not do.
Well, he wouldn't do it because he knows he wouldn't win.
But he has said in the past that he has the authorization he has the power to act unilaterally. What's the difference?
Well, the president does have the power to act unilaterally within the confines of the War Powers Resolution of 73. But again, you know, if the Congress, if it doesn't like it, I mean, 73 to 76% of the American people are against the United States taking unilateral action in Syria. So even if he does it, the Congress has the power of the purse. Now, it's an unpopular idea for the president to commit U.S. troops to Syria. And so if that's the case, we can go back to what we've learned from the Vietnam era, and the Republicans in the House, or even anti-war Democrats in the Senate, who are in the majority, could certainly put forth amendments or specific legislation to either bar it or defund it.
But assume for a second that the diplomatic mission fails. Obama takes military action. War Powers Act is pretty clear in giving him a 90-day latitude to do that. Does it require an affirmative action by Congress to stop it after 90 days, or does he have 90 days to get authorization?
No, first of all, it's 60 days, and he has 30 days to withdraw the troops. So,
but he's not talking about putting in troops. He's only talking about airstrikes.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because you're talking about committing armed forces to military action. Well, if you send the United States Air Force, even if you sent drones in, I mean, that's considered part of the armed forces. So he has 60 days to obtain authorization of the Congress to specifically use military force, or for the Congress to declare war.
So how is sending drones into Syria has not been authorized, but how's that different? This is the last question. How's that different? We've got drones in the tribal areas of Pakistan. We've got them in Afghanistan. Is that under the earlier resolution?
Yes. President George W. Bush obtained what's known as the authorization for the use of military force in the so-called, you know, at that time it was called the Global War on Terror. President Obama is now calling it overseas contingency operations, and the Congress has repeatedly renewed that over and over again.
We're out of time, and we thank you very much, John Hsu, former White House official, and we'll be back with a wrap-up on this. This is The Think Tank on KTAR 92.3.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR.
And we want to thank John Hsu, our constitutional lawyer. He served under two presidents, both the Bush presidencies, and he was chief judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review. We're getting him back for some FISA. We are not going to let him get off that easy talking about Vietnam and whatnot. We're going to talk some FISA soon enough. But Doc, I want to recap this. And, of course, with me is Dr. Mike O'Neill. You can catch him at MikeO'Neill.org for blogs, articles, also links to the archive Think Tank episodes, or on his day job, O'Neillresearch.com. This is his wheelhouse. This is what Dr. O'Neill has earned his living doing, and that is public opinion research. So I'm gonna circle back around, Doc, to public opinion, but I want to go back to the semantics of this, and this is what I learned today. I learned semantics. We started out with Congress during the Constitution Convention, Constitutional Convention. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you
okay,
got it.
Okay, the Constitutional Convention. It was make war. They said
in the discussions.
In the discussions,
that wasn't
make
the final
war
language.
Then they changed that because make war just sounds. Hey,
sounds like you're the general.
You're Rome at that point, right? I'm going to conquer foreign lands, right?
It ended up at declare war.
Declare war.
And president as commander in chief, which is undefined, but in effect implied that he's going to be the guy who executes.
Right. Exactly.
Now, as it's evolved, the thing that is really most striking about this country has had 100 armed conflicts in its history, only 5 declared wars. So one can make the case that the declaration of war is a pretty, pretty rare thing, and it only has occurred in those times when the country is completely mobilized thing. And in the last 100 years, this has been twice. This has been World War I and World War II. Everything else is called something else. I think the implication of this is, even though on paper Congress has the power to declare war, as a practical matter, since World War II, the president has pretty much had carte blanche to commit military effort.
Right.
And even since 1973 with the War Powers Act, which was an attempt not to establish presidential power, but to curtail it. This was a Congress that was in a country that was increasingly turning against the war, and a Republican president who was committed to executing it. And the War Powers Act was intended to curtail presidential power. But even that effort said, you've got 60 days during which you can do something, then you have to come back to Congress. The practical matter in terms of the politics of it, and this was absolutely true and used heavily during the Vietnam War, you commit American troops overseas. If you try to curtail that, you are politically portrayed as you are not supporting our troops, you are not really not patriotic. So as a practical matter, the president has had incredible power to commit military power. Now, Syria, there's one thing about this that I think is different from Vietnam, from Korea, all of those things, in particular, both Vietnam and Korea, at the front end, were popular. By the end, were very unpopular. A military action in Syria, what would be different is it would be unpopular from day one. And that may, as a political matter.
But what does President Obama care? President Obama doesn't care. He's not running. He's, okay, well, fine, don't vote for me again.
Well, the question is, if you do something like that and it's extremely unpopular and you don't bring the public with you, you become a lame duck pretty easily, and it undermines whatever presidential authority you have. Now, I think there is one thing that will potentially change this a little, and that is the president has signed on to a diplomatic initiative, and that, by the way, is overwhelmingly popular. Let's exhaust diplomatic remedies. There has been polling on it. That is very popular. Mm-hmm. If that one of two things happen, either that has some measure of success, and that will be popular because military action is not. If you go the diplomatic route and that fails, almost inevitably, the military option becomes somewhat more popular. How much I can almost always tell you with public opinion which way something's going to move.
Okay.
How far it moves, you need to do the surveys to find
right.
out.
Right. Absolutely.
So it's 3-1 against military action right now. If we really exhaust the diplomatic options, I'm telling you that support for military options will go up. I can't say how much, but I can say the direction. So he may have more support.
Had Putin not jumped in, would we have bombed already?
My guess is that the president boxed himself in. Well, two things.
He painted himself into multiple corners.
There was one out, which is he did request congressional authority. It's not clear that he gets it. And I think John's point is that while it is clear in his mind that the president has authority to commit troops, I think if Congress said no, he wouldn't do it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he said several times, I have the authority. I have the authority. I have the authority.
And you can maintain that you have the authority. And I think most people, if you look at the recent history of everything post-World War II, the president, in effect, has that authority. But whether or not you're going to use that authority, no president in the past has ever asked for congressional authority, not gotten it, and then acted.
Tell me this, from a public opinion standpoint, do we, if you would like to poll me as your first person, I will say no. Does the rest of the country really believe when a president says no boots on the ground? You're being sold something at that point, or no boots. Is it just a cloud of, hey, no one's going to get hurt? We're just going to lob some missiles over there. Don't worry about it. We're going to lob a few. No one's going to send a missile back. We're just going to lob a few and get the heck out of there. Does anyone believe that?
The country is war weary. We don't want another. I mean, we were promised Iraq and Afghanistan would be quick and easy, and obviously they weren't. And
right.
the country
but
is.
But we found where the chemical weapons
extremely,
went.
Extremely. Yeah, they went to Syria.
Exactly. We found where the weapons of mass destruction went.
He might have had this.
So the public has no stomach for more of that. I think the the notion that we can send, you know, bomb or missiles, in effect, what we're being promised is a kind of a cheap way out that we might be able to tolerate. A whole lot of people get hurt, but they're not us. And I think that's what that is trying to imply. Do people believe it? I think there's a lot of skepticism.
Sure.
You know, you get one toe in, and then it says, what if somebody does something else, and then you get another? I mean, if, for example, somebody in Syria were, if we bomb Syria and somebody pulls off a terrorist act in New York, are we not going to respond to that? Of course we're going to. So it's a toe in, and it's risky, and I think there's a lot of skepticism about that.
Because John Schumer actually mentioned dominoes falling. He was talking about a different conflict, but I think in Syria, I think we know now enough as a country, we know enough about the Middle East to know that if someone is hurt out there, someone else is going to retaliate.
And
it might not be at us, it'll be at someone else.
We're learning increasingly, and by the way, tune in next week, you'll hear more about this.
Of course
we are learning that the Middle East is a morass. And it's one of those things that there's like 100 ways to do something wrong and maybe one way to do it right. And it's almost impossible.
But we haven't discovered the one way to do it right.
We don't understand this world. There are fights there that have been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and interjecting ourselves into that, it's very difficult not to understand what we're getting into.
Now, we have Russia sending arms to the Assad regime. We have the United States.
To Syria, you mean, not to Assad.
Okay, but we also have us sending it to the rebels, so to speak, we're in the Star Wars, one of the Star Wars movies. But do we know who the good guys are? Are we dead set who the good guys are?
Well, we know that Assad is not a good guy.
Okay.
We know that some of the rebels may be worse.
Right.
But the question, is there anything remotely resembling a good guy there? John McCain seems to think that there's a lot of skepticism.
He's saying that because he wants to get the fight. He wants to get into the fight.
Well,
he wants to get in there and level the joint.
If you want to get in on one side, you got to basically make the case that there's somebody there who's good guys.
Yeah. And is there? Instead of asking you, does the public think that? Do any of us as citizens, do we think there's the guys there?
I don't think the public has clearly delineated notions. It's probably a lot of skepticism. And
sure.
That gets into a detail that I don't think the public knows.
I would hope the public would educate themselves, would try to get into that before we support one side or the other. And what I mean politically, whether we support the opposition to military action or we support the pro-military
action. Let me encourage folks to listen in next week. We're going to have a Middle East expert here.
A Middle East expert. Good night. Tony, this is getting so far over my head. I'm not going to lie to you. I thank goodness I'm here to make this all understandable. Bottom line, what you've learned from John Hsu today, has it helped you along the path of presidential war authority?
Well, I think what we've learned is there is huge presidential war authority. You just have to not call it a war.
You call it Operation Restoring Hope and Operation All Puppies and Kittens.
You call it whatever you want. And curtailing that since World War II has been very difficult. As I said, War Powers Act tried to do that, and all it did is end up underlining and underscoring what power the president does.
We want to thank John Hsu, attorney and constitutional expert, for joining us. Amazing insight. Dr. O'Neill, thank you so much for joining us. As always, thank you for spending time with us right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.